The world has gone mad, hasn't it? My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagritz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about episode 100, which will take place next week. We're very excited about that. However, you know, as we're trying to plan what are we going to do for our wonderful listeners in episode 100, it's pretty hard to keep up with the current pace of developments within the West and us just witnessing the United States crumbling in front of our eyes. Hi, Balder. How are you doing? How are you feeling about this topic and all these developments?
Hi, Dario. Well, confused, scared, bewildered. Let me take a thesaurus out and try to find more words to describe my current emotional state of mind. Now, the world is changing way more rapidly than I could have imagined. The 2025 was going to be an interesting year because of the Trump administration coming in. But the way that you see institutions crumbling in front of our eyes is intellectually fascinating and emotionally difficult to deal with, because it does mean that we're looking at the end of the era of Western, you know, Western liberal democracy. I don't think it's an overstatement. And it also means that our conversation about episode number 100 will be one about how our podcast has changed over time, because we started out mostly focusing on Western policy, typically bad foreign policy towards the rest of the world, how the West is arrogant, neocolonial, those kinds of things. But now more and more our conversations in this podcast are about the internal weakness and incompetence and inability of Western countries to manage their own affairs and to keep themselves from sliding down this very dark slope. And so I assume that today that will be also part of the conversation.
It most definitely will. And that's the really worrying part for me, is that you are currently worried and surprised by the pace of developments, because isn't your generation the one that's currently supposed to have everything under control so that us, the youth, can develop, you know, and rebel a little bit right now? Hello, is anyone thinking about our generation? We can't rebel right now, because how could you rebel in these times? Who would you rebel against? It's almost like the young generation has to be the reasonable one and say, okay, everyone, I know you're throwing a tantrum right now, but let's breathe, let's go think about our emotions. I mean, what's happening?
Yeah, that was, by the way, the most German "hallo" that I've ever heard in my life. But yeah, no, I think that's a very fair point. So one of the issues that I noticed as a professor is that typically when something horrible happens, like war between Russia and Ukraine, or the violence in Gaza, or anything like that, I as a professor take a step back and feel less concerned about the events than my students, because they this is the first time they observe this kind of event and they panic about it. They think that this might be incredibly important from a historical perspective rather than simply from a human well-being perspective. And typically my role is then to calm everything down. But right now it's the opposite. Right now I'm looking at events in the United States and to a lesser extent in Europe, and I am the one who is much more concerned than my students about what we are observing, because we are actually observing the hard work of hundreds of years of institution building basically collapsing. There is no significant movement stopping the events that are unfolding in Washington and in European capitals at the moment. And that is very, very scary to me. And it's almost feels that I have to convince your generation that this is something to be taken seriously.
Well, I can't speak for my peers. I can only speak for the ones around me. And I don't know, there's a lot of concern. I mean, you kind of said that you're feeling a little bit worried, right? I just feel a little, like my chest feels very heavy, right? If I really take a moment and think about everything that's happening in the world right now, right, not just the typical bad events that we have, right? Like, I mean, there are these moments, as you mentioned, like the violence in Gaza, where if you think about it, if you read about it, you watch about it, you just feel very sad, and you feel like, why is this happening? But witnessing what we're currently experiencing right now is on a different level because I can comprehend how bad the implications of this will be long term. And there's nothing I can do about it, right? I feel even more helpless than maybe usually, right? But at least with war, you've already, right? This is not my first war, unfortunately, I have to say, right? The first one I experienced. So you're already used to the desperation you feel. But with this slow and now faster decay of institutions, of things that I've been taught, almost brainwashed, right? Of how important they are to the functioning of our system. That makes me feel very heavy, but not in that sad way that I feel about war, but just heavy and yeah, empty.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the issue here. If you are Palestinian and you look at the past year and a half, that was an accelerated dynamic of something that had been going on for decades, namely the systematic loss of your country, the systematic, or at least of your land, the systematic loss of any hope for a Palestinian state. And that becomes something existential for you. But from a global humanity perspective, it doesn't really alter radically the course of history. Right, the course of history doesn't change depending on what happens in Gaza. For Palestinians, it does, but not for someone living in Beijing, not for someone living in Nairobi or someone living in Los Angeles. What we are seeing right now is not just a existential problem for Western countries, because it is, in the terms of who we are, who we're going to be in the future, but it's also an existential change for the rest of humanity, because the West still has this power, both intellectual as well as geopolitical, that its collapse is actually going to affect everyone, right? It is something that everyone is going to notice in some way or other. And that gives this real sense of anxiety. Like, it's not just that I was brought up thinking that we were all going to live in a liberal democracy forever, and that might very well now not be the case, and that my son might grow up in a completely different governance system. That is one observation. But another observation is that the whole of humanity will now take a different path because of this. China, India, Sub-Saharan Africa will have to behave differently at a global level now that this decline of the West has become so accelerated and so evident.
Looking back at the last 100 episodes, our first episode was published on July 7th, 2022. It's been an intense, interesting, fun 2.5 years. I very much invite you, the listeners, to kind of also look back at these topics that we've covered, and see whether there's anything you want us to look back on in episode 100, because that's what we will be doing, right? We will kind of look back, think about, wasn't it lovely to just talk about the Iran nuclear deal? Right, in episode number 2, where it was just about, you know, a policy. It wasn't about an existential struggle or a systematic change. No, it was just about a policy. It was about nuclear doctrine. Oh, what fun and light topics to talk about compared to what we're experiencing right now. I very much invite you, all the listeners, to kind of look back at some of the episodes, send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and let us know kind of your thoughts of the last 100 episodes and how times have changed. Because Balder, as you said, right? I mean, in the beginning, we very much focused on the outside. We've talked about the war in Ukraine, right? Terrorism, the Iran nuclear deal, right? We talked about China and Taiwan, aid and development, human rights, right? And in the last few episodes, we've been talking about, the elections in the United States, the outcome of this now, Trump's foreign policy as the leader, immigration in the West, right? It's such a changed world within such a, at least in my opinion, short period of time. Given that we will look back in episode 100, but we also want to look forward, one of the questions I have, Balder, for you, but also for the listeners, is, do we even want to talk about the United States anymore? Like, do we want to, because either is it a lost cause or is it too much and nobody wants to talk about it anymore? Do we no longer need to talk about it, or should we talk about it even more now that this is happening?
I would say the latter. The United States has always been the more interesting version of the Western bubble than Europe, in the sense that Europe has been around for much longer, has been in many ways less successful over the past 250 years than the United States, right? Peak liberal democracy surely came from the United States at some point. Let's say, I don't know, the 1990s or the 1970s, depends a little bit on what you value. And the downfall of the United States is also more extreme. So basically, the United States is a perfect case of where Western liberal democracy went wrong and was ever improving, how they overcame a lot of their institutional problems at the beginning, how they grew to become the first largest superpower in the world, and now how within a space of arguably 25 years, if you start from 9/11, they are falling down that hill and tumbling into a unknown future, but certainly not into a future liberal democratic system. And so talking about the United States is indirectly talking about the whole Western bubble and about liberal democracy more generally. And that makes much more sense than analyzing, let's say, Germany or the Netherlands or the UK, which is a more moderate and more boring, if you like, version.
I'm conflicted about this because, right, on the one hand, I hear in everyday conversations that people just don't want to hear about it anymore. And it also seems to be the attitude within the United States, right? It's almost like an ostrich, right, where I'll just put my head into the sand and I'm not seeing anything that's going on here. And then the problem might run away. I don't know.
But that is exactly part of the problem, right? That apathy, which we could maybe at some point, maybe in episode 100 or afterwards, unpack. You know, where does that apathy come from? There are loads of underlying causes. But that is one of the reasons why this is happening as it is happening. Because liberal democracy and the Western model only work if there is a sense of purpose. If there is a sense of, hey, we're working towards a better tomorrow. And given that that sense has completely disappeared, people have something like, well, what can I do? I'm just going to live from day to day and hope that everything will work out okay.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, this, I mean, at least for me, it's clear that I think we need to talk about the United States. But in the next 100 episodes, I want to try to kind of really funnel it into a few episodes, right? Of not having to talk about the United States every single week. But honestly, at the pace that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are going, it might be difficult.
Yeah, no, and historically, it is absolutely relevant. This is not some kind of Eurocentric view of the world. The United States has been and still is the most powerful, most influential nation, arguably, that the world has ever seen. And whatever happens in the United States affects everyone somewhere else. And this very dramatic decline of institutions that we are observing right now, especially in 2025, but that is like an accelerated version of years of this already occurring, is going to go down in history as a huge moment, in the way that we talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, or we talk about, you know, from a positive perspective, the start of civilizations, or this is a major, major watershed moment in human history. And I cannot emphasize that enough. And maybe some listeners say, hey, Baldur, you're exaggerating a little bit. Come on. No, I'm not exaggerating. This has nothing to do with whether you're left-wing or right-wing, or it has nothing to do in itself with political ideology. It is very, very clear that the project that was started 250 years ago with the Founding Fathers in 1776 is now in the United States coming to an end. And that cannot be ignored, and that needs to be talked about, and that needs to be studied, regardless of whether people want to hear it or not.
See, I feel like I just unlocked a new level or a new difficulty level in the video game that's called Life, because in the past 10 years, right, I always make this joke in the episodes that my generation has had a few too many once-in-a-lifetime crises, right? There was COVID, there was war, the energy crisis, and so on. But you just raised the bar. You just unlocked a new level and said, hey, this is a watershed moment in history, right? So I feel like after I've gone through all these levels at the beginning, which, you know, was economic crisis, refugee crisis, COVID, and so on, that now that I've survived them all somehow, I'm at the next level, and I'm living through a watershed moment in history.
Absolutely. But this is what I was referring to before with respect to me and my students over the past 10 years or 15 years or so, that Ukraine or other crises didn't radically alter the course of history. Ukraine doesn't alter the course of history. It alters it for Ukrainians, no doubt about it, and the victims who are directly affected by the violence. But history books will see it as a isolated case in broader patterns. Why this is a watershed moment is that this is the end of an era. This is the end of a century of many centuries of Western development moving upwards towards a certain utopia. And now it becoming clear not only that that utopia will not be reached, but that we're now rolling down the other side of the hill. And that doesn't mean that in 4 years' time or in 8 years' time, there's going to be a Western world, a Europe or North America without elections. Elections will continue to be held. There will still be semblance of institutions. But what is happening right now in 2025 as a accelerated version of most of the 21st century is the end of this very important era of global politics. And that is very different from all the other crises that we've seen. The only thing that you could point out is that COVID and the war on terror lay the foundations of what we're observing, right? So COVID itself didn't alter history. COVID altered the history of people who died during COVID. But the way that governments reacted and the way that society became more tribal because of COVID and the psychological damage that was done because of anti-COVID measures laid the foundations for what we're observing right now. The same could be said about the war on terror.
Well, and the war in Ukraine, right, and the economic crisis of 2008, and the refugee crisis of 2015 to 17, is that Western behavior that we've analyzed throughout the last 100 episodes, well, last 98 episodes, I should say, that all of them have kind of laid the groundwork for where we are right now. Therefore, right, to set up next week's episode, we want to observe the problems or all the happenings of the past 2-3 months. And then next week, we hope to kind of provide some guidance on how to deal with this and hopefully some positivity as well. So starting with the United States and what has been happening in the last few months. Boulder, you should be very happy, actually, as far as I'm concerned, right? I paid attention in class when I was your student. I paid attention in this podcast. Elon Musk and Donald Trump have completely defunded basically US Aid, right? The United States Agency for International Development. So you must be celebrating right now because, again, I mean, we've talked about this in the episode and in class, that aid and development is not a good thing.
Actually, I didn't know that you were going to raise this point, but I'm very happy that you did, because this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Anyone who knows me a little bit knows that I am deeply, deeply critical of aid programs in general. I've been part of it for the first 5-6 years of my career, and then I ran away screaming because of what I saw around me. And arguably, USAID or USAID, if depending on how you want to pronounce it, has been a major, major target of my criticism. There is a lot wrong with the way that foreign aid occurs, and specifically how the United States goes about foreign aid. But that's exactly the point. This is not about my perspectives on that. It's about good governance. And in no universe, despite my inherent dislike, my intuitive dislike for US aid, in no rational analysis could you argue that just from one day to the other, defunding such an important government agency, it leads to good results, leads to good outcomes. If I were somehow a top advisor in the White House, I may make the case that we need to slowly start transition away from US aid. But to say from one day to the other, that's it, bye-bye, is causing way more damage to the US position worldwide, as well as to the people who are directly affected. People all of a sudden without financing, without jobs, without, in some cases, livelihoods. then you will actually benefit from any of this. So that's exactly, I'm delighted. You can see that I've got a big smile on my face that you use this example, because that is exactly what we're talking about here. This is not about ideology. This is not about who I like and who I dislike. I dislike US-8, but I believe more in the importance of institutions. And it is terrible, terrible management of institutions to just go, okay, we shut you down. Bye-bye. That's it. That is not how a well-functioning system is supposed to work.
Well, for the listeners who didn't know your stance on development aid before, right? You can listen to that episode, obviously on the podcast here. It's episode 9 for everyone who's interested, and basically the criticisms of us, actually. I mean, I've been heavily influenced by you there. So of you on the aid and development sector.
Sorry, but before you move on, then we should probably point out to our listeners that if this is episode 9, this was when we were still experimenting a little bit with our podcast. And so certain, stylistic and content inadequacies should be forgiven, right? I think that we've become smoother over time, and it's important for our listeners to remember that.
I think we have become very smooth in the meantime. Just as smooth as this transition. So moving on from... Right, defunding a whole US agency. Who was that person? It was Elon Musk and his lackeys. And that's the next development, right? I think we have to focus on from the past 2 months, and we need to look at next week, is the fact that a person who wasn't elected, right, who, if anything, bought himself into that team with approximately $300 million, that he, right, the richest man in the world, now gets to decide or have a lot of influence within the United States government of what to cut and what to keep. And he's doing it exactly the same way he did it at Twitter 2 years ago.
Yeah, and the fact that you point out that he's the richest man in the world is not something to be underestimated. There is a reason why good governance requires a limitation to power. Basically, you don't want too much power in the hands of too few people, because that leads to inherent corruption. But even if it doesn't lead to corruption, at a very minimum, it causes ineffective policymaking, because there is no counterbalance. This is exactly why liberal democracy, as set up by the founding fathers, is all about balance. It's all about moderate progress, right? Sometimes people think that democracy is about majority rule. In many ways, it's about protection of minorities. The majority chooses a government, and then that government is severely limited in what it can do in order not to have the tyranny of the masses. And now, with that completely collapsing and the richest person in the world having this almost unfettered access to decision-making within the White House, to information flows within government agencies, is creating a deeply, deeply destructive, toxic dynamic within the liberal framework and institutional framework that has carried the United States through these centuries. That is something that people seem to be desperately underestimating, right? It's not about whether you like Elon Musk or not. It's not about whether Elon Musk has some good ideas or not. It's not about corruption within government institutions. It's about basic foundational principles of, here you've got a state, that state needs to be respected, and on top of that, a government can tweak that state a little bit. Currently, Elon Musk and the White House are not tweaking the state. They're not moving a little bit left or right. They're taking a sledgehammer and they're completely collapsing it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a heavy topic today. And maybe the media in the United States and the US Democrats are feeling exactly the same way I am feeling right now. A little bit just exhausted by all of this, because we're not really hearing anything from them. Hello, I'm missing. Again, it's the second hello today, right? It really shows you how desperate I am. But I'm searching for the U.S. opposition and for the fourth estate, right? I'm searching for the U.S. media who are critically covering this and maybe pushing back. I'm also searching for the U.S. population that's out there on the streets mass protesting. It's concerning, the lack of it.
And again, the way to explain that would be looking at rather complex and long-term dynamics that are quite difficult to change, right? So, for example, why are people in the streets not protesting? Well, part of it is that apathy that you just described. Part of it is that in the current system, especially if you're in the United States, it's actually very difficult to get the day off to protest. You know, it's not easy to say to your boss, hey, sorry, I'm going to go to Washington to protest. That has all kinds of negative consequences, especially with the lack of workers' rights and all that kind of thing. So therefore, you see less of a demonstration protest culture in the United States than, for example, what you would see in France to name a not so random country when it comes to protests. And the media has been for a decade now, ever since the first election of Donald Trump in 2016, very, very busy with essentially mocking Trump and MAGA supporters. But mocking Trump and MAGA supporters, as we've said multiple times during the past 2 years in this in episodes, is not helpful. Because it is basically mocking dynamics that can be very destructive, and we need to understand those dynamics. We need to know why 75 million people vote for Donald Trump. What is the thinking behind it? Why are they okay with this kind of approach to their own society and their own future? And the media, therefore, now has nothing else to say because they've been crying wolf for 10 years, and now that it's actually really important, now that the media needs to stand up and say, no, 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 this cannot be. People, you have to be very concerned because your future is on the line. The country you're so proud of is about to disappear. Nobody takes the media seriously anymore because they've been shouting and yelling for a very long time about the wrong things. And now that they are needed, it's exactly like the boy who cried wolf.
Are they taking themselves seriously, the media?
I have no idea. I don't know to what extent journalists for the New York Times or for the CNN or MSNBC, how they perceive themselves at the moment. But I do know that they are at the moment incapable of holding power to account. They're writing some articles here and there. They're warning here and there. But it's clear that their impact has very, very drastically been reduced. Now, you could look at also at the advent of social media and that traditional media no longer have the same voice as they used to, but it's very obvious that there is no concerted effort by the current US or international media to actually say, this is where we have to now step in. Maybe tired from mocking Trump for over a decade.
Let's move on to another Western country where it's not going too well with its institutions, to a country that doesn't receive so much attention in this podcast, to your country, Balder. And an institution that I didn't know about and I find fascinating because it kind of tingles right my senses when it comes to that feeling of technocracy that I sometimes, you know, on late nights when I've had to read too much about Trump, I wish for. But the Rat van Staat, Balder, what is that?
It's an institution that has been around for a very long time within Dutch politics, which is an organization outside of parliament, outside of government, that basically advises and it has certain decision power in certain cases, but it mostly advises on policy. And it publishes reports on proposed policies by governments. And it is a deeply respected institution that is taken essentially as an informal arbiter of whether policies can go ahead or not. And parliament typically takes that very seriously, and government takes that very seriously. And why it is yet another sign of how liberal democracy is on the decline is that thinking of institutions being a balance of power, or at least a source of balance of power, balancing power and taking away some of the abilities of the executive, of the government, to make aggressive choices in society. That makes a lot of sense. And it's an important pillar, in that sense, of Dutch liberal democracy. Now, only this week, they announced that they are going to advise against a current immigration policy that a government, the very much right-wing government, anti-immigrant government has proposed. The Raad van State is saying, no, this is probably not going to be a good idea and this should not happen. Historically, that would mean that the government has to go back to the drawing board. And now, immediately on the same day that this came out, the minister responsible for immigration said, we believe that our policy is correct and we're going to completely ignore this advice. That in itself is unheard of in Dutch politics, and it is deeply disturbing for anyone who believes in that kind of power balance, right? It is good if you are a supporter of anti-immigrant policy and you say, I'm very happy that my government is actually now fulfilling the promise and is going to make life for asylum seekers and refugees much more difficult. But it is bad for anyone who actually wants their country to be liberal and democratic.
Absolutely. Speaking of another country that wants to be liberal and democratic, Germany. Hi. Right. I mean,
hello.
Hello. Hello here from Germany. 15 points. It's 12 points. Ah, that was embarrassing. As the listeners know, I assume, Germany is facing elections in 2.5 weeks. Very exciting, right? And it's a little bit concerning, right? Reporting from here, because I do feel like I'm reporting, given that I work so closely with German politics by now. But very similar developments that we're seeing in all other Western countries that are currently on the decline, we're also seeing here in Germany, and that's with the new leadership of the Conservative Party, right? The party that's currently not in the government, but will be in the government most likely, given the polls. And there's a party leader who reminds me a little bit of Musk sometimes, right? Friedrich Merz, because he's the former CEO of BlackRock Germany. Right, BlackRock, the biggest investment fund in the world, right, moving enormous sums of money from left to right, wielding a lot of power, having a lot of interests, and that former CEO gets to now be chancellor, and it's very concerning to hear to read the reports coming out, but also to hear like the things that I'm hearing from kind of like the things that are going on behind the scenes, is how much power and how much pressure he and his clique are basically exerting on the rest of the Conservative Party to push for his agenda and for his points ahead of the elections, and then seemingly also kind of after the elections. Because, I mean, for the ones who don't know, right, but Germany is a very proud country when it comes to its parliamentary democracy, when it comes to its political parties. They have a long tradition. The parties that are here, right, that are in parliament have been there for decades, a lot of them. But he is currently taking his own party out in that sense, where he's silencing or putting a lot of pressure on anyone who is going against him. And it's really just 10 people within the party kind of running the show as of now. And this went so far that your good friend Angela Merkel even had to come out the other day and say, I do not agree with how he's running this party. I do not agree with the direction this party is heading, and I'm very concerned, right? And that's one of those other like little symptoms within the Western bubble where you just see that, right, those strong institutions of liberal Western democracy that we always value so much, that we talk about so much, that they're slowly but surely being hollowed out, right? It's slowly but surely, you know, to advance their own agenda, to advance their own agenda a little bit quicker, without as much problems, without having to take on compromises, right? That's a very concerning development that I'm seeing here. And the worst thing is, the population, right, is hearing about this as well, but the polling numbers are not changing in any significant way, right? It's that, if anything, they're kind of increasing slightly.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say slowly hollowing out, because that reminds me of an episode, the hollowing out of institutions that we recorded a long time ago. But this is the problem, right? It's no longer slow, because this, what you're describing, is something that's also visible, for example, in the United Kingdom with the Starmer government and arguably the Tories as well, doing exactly the same thing. Basically, no longer interested in intellectual debate within their parties. They're only looking for how do we consolidate power and how do we manage to push through a very specific agenda that we believe is the right one. Now, and some people might say, isn't that what political parties are supposed to do? Well, yes, but always on the basis of our political party is the political top of a government and a country and a state that is more important than any ideological perspective, right? So I might have a right-wing or left-wing perspective, but my perspective needs to be secondary to the well-being of the state, to the well-being of intellectual conversations, to the well-being of how my country is run from an institutional perspective. And that is now being completely thrown out of the window. It's all about power. It's all about your tribe winning. And the idea that there is a responsibility beyond winning, that there's a responsibility beyond your political tribe, well organized by those 10 people you mentioned, is completely absent from current day thinking, right? It's that BlackRock mentality of, no, it's just about controlling dynamics. It's not about anything else anymore. It's not about complex conversations about what kind of world we want. It's not about listening to others and being convinced by good arguments. It's about setting the agenda, executing that agenda, and moving on. And that is, I would argue, almost automatically the end of any well-functioning liberal system. Because a liberal system requires the opposite. It requires space and time to listen to each other and to argue with each other and to have these intellectual clashes and to be okay with sometimes losing a political fight, because that is what happens in a well-functioning democracy.
And then the last thing, and this is an element that we have talked about for 99 episodes now, is the lack of intellectual thinking in the Western world, right? It's, I mean, again, here in this case study in Germany, it's only about, okay, how can I advance my own agenda quicker? In the Netherlands, it's about, oh, these intellectuals who have been giving me advice for the past hundreds of years, let me just ignore them. And in the United States, is Elon Musk in charge, and he's not an intellectual. Right? So that's one of those, I mean, things that we just see, well, so evidently the last 2-3 months, but we've been really seeing for the last 99 episodes.
Again, liberal democracy is a deeply intellectual project at its core. It requires a understanding of the fundamentals of enlightenment. It requires an understanding of the nature of humanity, the fact that it is not simply about political or economic power, but that it is also about broad societal well-being. Hey, we're all trying to get along in this country or in this region, and let's start by being nice to each other, and based on that, we're going to have deep conversations about what kind of society we want to create, what the importance is of power balance. This is why you see the founding fathers in the 18th century, the founding fathers of the United States, having these enormous intellectual exchanges, letters being written back and forth, debates being held, in order, like, what is it that makes society prosperous and a tool to enhance the well-being of its citizens? That is a deeply, deeply intellectual exercise. And in 2025, just look at Merz, look at Starmer in the UK, look at Musk in the United States. There is no interest and there's no space for that intellectual conversation. It is all about power and your agenda being pushed through. It is honestly a very, very sad sight to behold. And it's especially problematic because there is no clear solution to it, right? It is the consequence of decades of 21st century mismanagement of society. And it's a consequence of technological and other societal changes that make the electorate and the broad population not capable of assessing this properly.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the 99th episode and ahead of our 100th episode next week. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, or you want to tell us something ahead of next week's episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, given that we just finished on the question of intellectualism in Western society, it seems apt to quote a bit of German existentialism or nihilism, if you like. specifically the great Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, "Hope in reality is the worst of all evils because it belongs to torments of men."